What we tried to do last week is to make the point that the concept of drawing near to God in worship is something that the whole Bible tries to educate us about, either to give us a background against which we can understand what happens when the human, the earthbound human who lives not only in the spirit, but also in the flesh, seeks to draw near to the heaven-dwelling God, who is spirit, but who cannot be seen or touched in the same way that we can. There, for us to understand what happens in that process, God lays down something, you can call it a motif or a paradigm or whichever way you'd like to think of it. But it involves the concept, these three concepts that we tried to show last week. Tabernacle, priesthood, and sacrifice. And what we tried to illustrate last week is the idea that these three aspects of worship are something which God sets forth by His own careful design. He provides these three institutions as gifts to man, which allow man to draw near to Him. These are all very meaningful. You can see that in the way, the detail with which the pattern is provided for these things, the detail with which the gathering of the material and the constructing of them and so forth, and then the consecrating of the priesthood and all the detail about the sacrifices that are found in Exodus and Leviticus especially, and those things are set forth. What becomes noticeable then is that these same three institutions are used to explain the ministry and the work of Christ. He tabernacles among us. He enters the Holy of Holies, and then through the Eternal Spirit offers His own blood as one sacrifice for sins forever, and now dwells to appear before the face of God for us, to make intercession for us. So we're enabled to understand the ministry of Christ, at least partly by the worship system that God set forth in the Old Testament. Then we tried to point out that these same three terms are used by the New Testament to help the church understand itself. 1 Peter 2 and verse 5, 4 and 5, especially these three terms. We become a spiritual house, a tabernacle or a temple, and a holy priesthood to offer up spiritual sacrifices that are acceptable to God through Christ. And that is the concept, the overall view, which lets us understand something of what goes on when we draw near, when people draw near to God for worship. Tabernacle, priesthood, sacrifice. Now, I want for us to spend the bulk of our class today noticing more carefully how especially the concept of priesthood plays out in the ministry of Christ. And what we're going to do is to read and try to ask ourselves some questions about sections of the great book of Hebrews where this one concept is what the Hebrew writer uses to do one thing for Christians. What would you say is the overall purpose of the book of Hebrews? You, if you're like me, and if it's one of your favorite parts of the New Testament, what's the overall purpose of this book? Is it Is it to scold? Is it to introduce or to teach, to educate in some brand new concept? I mean, what's the overall purpose of this book?
Encouragement.
Right. This is the so for the church to have the spiritual energy to keep on serving God without letting weariness or boredom overtake it, and then for it to fall victim to such things, the church, this writer believes, needs to understand the priesthood of Christ. Now, why is that so important to him, to us? Let's if you have your paper, we're at number 4, Christ and His Church. Christ the High Priest of His Church, and we're at number 4 now, and I've made the point that since this is this work of Christ is central to this whole concept of worship that we're talking about, then we want you to help us identify the implications of the statements about the priesthood of Christ. Let's start by noticing in chapter 10 and verse 21, the way in which Christ is described by the Hebrew writer in this one verse, Hebrews 10:21. It's not a surprise. I have it on your paper there. I just want you to understand what we're saying to start with. Hebrews 10:21. How's he described in that verse?
High priest.
All right. A great priest over the house of God. All right? And Eddie said what that means. If he's a priest over the house of God, what kind of priest is he, Eddie?
High priest.
He's the high priest. The house of God in the New Testament is what? The church. So the great high priest of this tabernacle means that he's the high priest of the church, and hence the reason for our reading, for our thinking about it this way. I'll start with Hebrews 9, verses 6 and 7. I want to just choose some passages here that try to think about this. Hebrews 9, verses 6 and 7. Now, this gets down to the nub of the argument that the writer is making in this book. He names over all of the regulations and the parts and the furnishings of the tabernacle in the first 5 verses. And then, John, what does he say in 6 and 7?
These preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section, performing their ritual duties. But into the second, only the high priest goes, he but once a year, not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people.
All right, so what was the special function of the Jewish high priest?
Make sacrifice for people's sins.
All right, he, in doing so, the other priest could go into the first section of the tabernacle, which was called what? The holy place, but this, the high priest, could go into the second, which was called what?
Most.
All right, he could enter the most holy place, also called the Holy of Holies, and I'll just call it that here for a second, the Holy of Holies, and in doing so, he could make atonement. What was the one day a year in which the high priest entered the most holy place as representative of the people? What was that day called in the Old Testament? Right, exactly. It's Leviticus chapter 16. You remember very carefully how there was the sin offering, and then there's also the scapegoat. And how after the high priest makes atonement for his own sin with the blood of a sin offering, then he confesses the the sins of the people over the head of the one animal, and then the other one is offered, and then the one is sent off into the wilderness, and the blood of the other one is taken and sprinkled where? In the most holy place, but where in the most holy place? The mercy seat, right. So in this way is a visible way of saying that in order for worship to occur, there has to be relationship established and maintained. What would sin do to the relationship between man and God?
Separates.
So in making atonement, I had a teacher one time in my college days who said the way you understand this is at 1 minute. So if sin separates from God and an atoning sacrifice is offered, what is the purpose of that? What is this high priest doing when he enters the most holy place and makes and sprinkles the blood on the mercy seat where God meets his people, where God dwells there in the camp of his people? He is maintaining this relationship. So the concept of worship involves the idea of relationship, and the special function of the Jewish high priest is to enter the Holy of Holies in behalf of the people. All right, nobody else could do that but this high priest, this particular individual. That would suggest if we come down centuries later and we come to the claim that Jesus is the high priest over the house of God, what does this suggest then about his work?
He does the same thing.
All right, that he does it actually for us. This is only a shadow of the real thing. That he actually enters where for us? The presence of God. The real Holy of Holies. Heaven itself. And he makes atonement for us. With how? I'm giving away some of the rest of the story here. So, in other words, you're going to have repetition in a minute. But he does it by offering the blood of a sacrifice, which actually can take away sin. How often did the Day of Atonement happen?
Once a year.
All right, every year. What did that mean?
He had to continually do it.
Why did he have to continually do it? All right, because people kept on sinning, and the blood of bulls and goats cannot do what? It cannot take away sins. God provides it a way to let people keep on relying on him by covenant, but a sacrifice has to be made. All right, let's look at a little more detail then about this same idea, Hebrews 5, verses 1 through 4. While we read this, ask yourself, what would be required of anyone who was to serve in this role of high priest? Look for all the things in this reading that would be required of anybody. In other words, could I just say, you know, I'm interested in people. I want to be a religious leader. So I'm going to declare myself the high priest of the north side. Could I do that? Let's read this passage and think about it here. Hebrews 5, verses 1 through 4. Brendan?
For every high priest taken from among men is appointed on behalf of men in things pertaining to God in order to offer both gifts and sacrifices for sin. He can deal gently with the ignorant and misguided, since he himself also is beset with weakness. And because of it, he is obligated to offer sacrifices for sins, as for the people, so also for himself. And no one takes the honor to himself, but receives it when he is called by God, even as Aaron was.
All right, now what it would be required of anyone who is going to have this role of high priest to enter the Holy of Holies to make atonement?
Sacrifice. selected by God.
All right, he would have to be chosen or appointed by the one he was going to draw near to. All right? Appointment by God to offer gifts and sacrifices, and I'm put up here this way, to serve on behalf of man. Now look at the verse that's there, and what it says, and tell me where this last part comes in. The idea about worship is you don't draw near or just walk in to the presence of God on your own terms. Worship does not occur just based on what you and I want or like or feel like. It involves appointment by God, and the Hebrew writer, if you think about it, makes this point twice. In verse 1 and then verse 4, both times he says, appointed by God or called by God, you don't take this honor on yourself. But now, notice what verse 2 says. At the end of verse 1, you act on behalf of men in relation to God. In verse 2, what does it say? He can deal gently with the ignorant and wayward. Now, how is Jesus like that, and how is he not like what verse 2 says? It goes ahead to say, since he himself is beset with weaknesses. How does that apply to Christ, and how does it not apply to Christ?
Well, we know it was sinless.
All right, first, he may be beset with weaknesses in the sense that he was made like us, that he can be touched with the feeling of our infirmities, that he endured all of the temptations and so forth that you and I face, but he is not touched with weakness in the sense that he committed any sin. All right, so that is a part. So you have a man who is appointed by God to serve on behalf of man. All right, so we see that idea. We bear that in mind. Now skip down to chapter 7, verse 28. And I probably put a little longer section here than I needed to, but down through verse 8, chapter 8, verse 6. And let's read it. Read that section for a second. Jeremy, do you have that before you? 7:28 through 8:6.
For the law appoints men in their weakness as high priests, but the word of the oath, which came later than the law, appoints a son who has been made perfect forever. Now the point in what we are saying is this. We have such a high priest.
We have such a high priest. Okay.
One who is seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, a minister in the holy places, in the true tent that the Lord set up, not man. For every high priest is appointed to offer gifts and sacrifices. Thus it is necessary for this priest also to have something to offer. Now if he were on earth, he would not be a priest at all, since there are priests who offer gifts according to the law. They serve a copy and shadow of the heavenly things. When Moses was about to erect the tent, he was instructed by God, saying, "See that you make everything according to the pattern that was shown you on the mountain." But as it is, Christ has obtained a ministry that is as much more excellent than the old as the covenant he mediates is better, since it is enacted on better promises.
All right, thank you, Jeremy. Now, how is the high priesthood of Christ different from any other? There's more than one way here. But start in verse 28 of chapter 7, and you get an idea to start with here. What was, and put the focus on the perfect forever part of verse 26. What were the two problems of Old Testament high priests? Two problems that they all were subject to.
Sin.
First, their own sins. So that was a notice that we read a while ago. When he goes into the most holy place, he has to offer first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. That's the first problem. What's the second problem? And it involves the idea of the word forever, by the way, and the contrast that's being drawn here. What one thing could you be sure of with an Old Testament high priest?
Happens again next year.
All right, that part, but that's a part of what I'm saying.
They're all mortal.
All right, John, go ahead and say it another way. They all died. All right, someone else would have to step in and serve until what? He died too. All right, that's the problem. You keep having these high priests who die. And the Hebrew writer is using that point in this passage here to say that we have in Christ a high priest who has been made perfect, meaning what?
Without sin.
Without sin, no need to offer anything for his own sacrifice, and forever, meaning what? He won't die anymore. So the idea now is that with a high priest like this who's seated at the right hand of the throne of the majesty in heaven, you and I have the very thing which God had been preparing for from the beginning. And he makes the point about the care with which God provided the pattern for the tabernacle and such like, and insisted that these things be made according to the pattern. And he says that Jesus serves in the true tent with the real priesthood. So, let me ask it this way. When God did all of that with Moses and the Israelites in the wilderness, was he preparing then to send Christ to do for us what he's doing in heaven now?
Yes.
So the idea of worship that goes on here is something which involves the covenant relationship that comes through Christ. He ends that section that we just read by talking about the ministry of Christ, then mediating a better covenant enacted upon better promises and being a more excellent ministry and so forth. So we have the privilege now of drawing near to God through one who is seated at his right hand. So I'm going to say it this way. We have the true privilege of covenant. What God has been preparing for the whole time. And we can draw near to his presence in the true tent, which is heaven itself. So we have the true privilege of covenant, that idea. Now there's one thought here that I want to call your attention to a little more carefully. I don't have it on the paper. Look at verse 4 and tell me what the implications of verse 4 are. Hebrews 8, verse 4. What does the Hebrew writer mean by this? How is this true? Now, if he were on earth, what?
Well, he came to establish the covenant.
All right, that's true, but if he were on earth,
he wouldn't be a priest.
All right, why would he not be a priest?
He wasn't because he's not priestly tribe.
All right. Say it.
He's not like them.
All right, he's not like them. In what way is he not like them?
He has not been offered up, buried, and risen.
All right, that's for certain. He couldn't be at the right hand of God if we were on heaven, but there's more to it.
He wasn't a man.
Melinda, say it. What did you say?
He wasn't from the tribe.
All right. He was not, if he were on earth, what kind of high priest would there have been on earth?
He
They would have been Levites. They would have been from the tribe of Aaron. And Jesus was from which tribe?
Judah.
All right, so this is an interesting point now to think about, because you run across people who will say, well, I ought to be able to do this in worship because they did it in the Psalms, or they did it in 1 Samuel, or whatever. Ought to be able to do that in worship because of this. Well, they had a physical tabernacle and a fleshly priesthood under the law of Moses. Look, the Hebrew writer makes this point more specifically in chapter 7. So I want you to back up. Look at chapter 7 and verse 11. Okay, who has it read? Dan, read for us if you would.
Now, if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, and for on the basis of it the people received the law, what further need was there for another priest to rise according to the order of Melchizedek and not be designated according to the order of Aaron?
All right, let me explain for a second. What he's getting at here is that a priest after the order of Melchizedek was brought up in Psalm 110, which was written by David a long time after the priesthood of the sons of Aaron was established in the wilderness at Mount Sinai. So the argument the writer is making is that if people could have been in perfect relationship with God through the priesthood of Aaron, why would God have brought up and promised to David a descendant who would be a priest like Melchizedek? Melchizedek, of course, met Abraham, what is it, in Genesis 13 or Genesis 14, and he just appears on the stage, and in Hebrews we find out that Melchizedek doesn't have beginning or ending, and his priesthood is not based on a physical lineage and so forth, and that's the argument that he's being made. All right, Dan, back to the text now, verse 12.
For when the priesthood is changed, of necessity there takes place a change of law also.
All right, what's he mean by that?
Priest dies.
All right, the law required that the sons of Aaron, the people from the tribe of Levi, be the priests. If you're going to come in under the law when David was living and promise a high priest from some other line, what are you promising? What are you assuring? You are assuring that there will have to be a change of the law. Okay, go ahead, Dan, verse 13.
For the one concerning whom these things are spoken belongs to another tribe, from which no one has officiated at the altar.
All right, verse 14.
For it is evident that our Lord was descended from Judah, a tribe with reference to which Moses spoke nothing concerning priests.
All right. So you can see the idea here. We have to, when we talk about covenant, the idea of worship involving this covenant relationship, then you can see that the high priesthood of Jesus is significant, because it means that there was a change in covenant, and that has to be respected with this. All right, chapter 2:17 and 4:14 now, and I ask here, how is Christ uniquely qualified for this task of high priest? What is there about him that could not be said for anybody else, aside from, of course, the fact that he did not sin? All right, 2:17. Somebody have it found?
Therefore he had to be made like his brethren in all things, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest in things pertaining to God, to make propitiation for the sins of the people.
All right, so look at this idea. Like his brothers, I'm not done yet, so don't ring the bell. And look in chapter 4 and verse 14. Verse 14. What's it say?
Therefore, since we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God, let us hold fast our confession.
All right, so look at this idea. Has passed through the heavens. So what two things are we being told here that qualify him uniquely to be our high priest, or high priest over the house of God? He can identify with us, but he also has deity. He is at home in the presence of God. All right? He fits in the presence of God. So he identifies both with man and with God, and can therefore be a what? Don't say high priest. He can offer sacrifice, but he can be a mediator. He can be someone who is able to identify with both parties for whom he intends to accomplish at one-ment. All right, look quickly now at these last two passages. 7:25 through 27, Michelle, would you get that? And 9:24 through 26, Melinda, would you get that, please? And let's ask ourselves here now, what does he do for his people as high priest? Now, you may think, well, we really haven't gotten down to worship here. But if you'll think about this, this turns out to be the entire framework within which New Testament worship happens among the people of God. This is what we respond to, or what we make use of when we worship. All right, 7:25 through 27, Michelle.
Therefore, he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. For such a high priest was fitting for us, who is holy, harmless, undefiled, separate from sinners, and has become higher than the heavens, who does not need daily, as those high priests, to offer up sacrifice, first for his own sins and then for the people's. For this he did once for all when he offered up himself.
All right, now what does he do for us there? Notice that it's not just his sins that don't need to be sacrificed for anymore. It's also ours that don't need to be sacrificed for anymore, because he has done it. So what does he do now for us? He makes intercession. He ever lives. He's completely able to save. Chapter 9, 24 through 26, Melinda.
Okay. For Christ has entered, not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy places every year with the blood, not his own. For then he would have had to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself.
All right. So when we with Christ as our high priest, worship today, are we seeking cleansing in the process of worshiping? Or are we thanking God through Christ for the cleansing that he has given us through Christ?
The latter.
Yes. Now, we may discover in the process of worshiping that we need to ask God to cleanse us through his Son for what has been amiss. We may be confronted with the difference between our ideal state of holiness in Christ and our actual state of lack of holiness in our lives. That may happen. But the point of worship with Christ as the high priest, and our being the household of God, and our worshiping spiritual sacrifices, is to draw near to God in thanksgiving for the complete, effective cleansing that has been provided through the mediator who makes intercession for us, and to be offering spiritual sacrifices that glorify God through him. Now, we'll pursue that idea of spiritual sacrifice next week. You're still going to need both sheets here. We got one last thing on this first one, and we'll try to attend to these. It's really good to see you guys. Jeremy, you guys. Laura, you guys. Thanks for being with us today. Everybody have a good Labor Day and a really good first week of September.